Great. Can people hear me okay? Great. Well, welcome back from lunch, and thanks again. We switch to my PC. We're going to go ahead and kickstart again. This is the third segment here. This is our last segment here. We're going to cover a couple things in this one. One is going to be AI, and then we'll talk about hybrid, specifically with Azure Stack and some of the work that we're doing there. And then we're going to move into a tips and tricks area, and so I'll talk about some sort of advanced tips and tricks that you can take advantage of, whether it's around security, whether it's around some additional alerting and logging, cost management, how to lower your bill, and a whole bunch of other cool best practices that I think you'll find super useful. And generally what I find is both newcomers find it useful, and then even advanced Azure users usually go, I had no idea about half those things. And so hopefully some good tips and tricks you can use. So let's start off by talking about AI. So, I mean, one of the things that I'm sure everyone here is seeing in the world today is just, the rise of AI becoming something that we use more and more and expect more and more inside the applications and services that we use. And as a developer, how do I go take advantage of AI capabilities in the applications I build and you build? And, with Azure, we have a bunch of different ways that you can take advantage of that. And, the cool thing is, when you can actually take software and data and put it together, you can really build some amazing things. Now, how many people here are data scientists? No one. One person. Okay. That's okay, because that's often the answer I usually get in these talks. And I'm not a data scientist either, so don't feel bad. We all aren't. But hey, we still want to be able to build cool stuff. And so one of the things that we have inside Azure that's pretty nice is something we call our Azure Cognitive Services. And these are AI services. They're exposed with REST endpoints. And they also have, strongly typed, in the case of .NET and Java, as well as language wrappers for dynamic languages, APIs that you can call. And you can basically add AI into your application without having to be a data scientist. So if you remember that cat review moderation app, where we were checking an image to see if a cat was in it, that's an example of calling one of our vision APIs. And you pass an image, it returns back what's in it, and you go. That Twitter app where we were checking on sentiment on Azure tweets, that was calling one of our sentiment analysis APIs that was doing text analysis. There's lots more. I think we have about 27 of these APIs now that you can call and take advantage of and use inside your applications. So let's go ahead and walk through just a couple other cool, simple demos that showcase some of the things that you can do that are pretty fun. So this is an app you can download. It's on GitHub as well. It's a client-side app. And one of the things you'll see here is it is calling Azure. And it's using my local webcam. And ooh, check that out. Ooh, see in the background. And it's actually doing here image face detection. You see that little box that's moving around. That's all dynamic. And check this is really cool, actually. You'll notice in addition to detecting my face, it's detecting my gender, so it knows I'm a man, and it's roughly approximating my age. Depending on how much sleep I got the last night, I'm 40 now. Oh, no, got older. Roughly, approximates your age. And the reason it's roughly is it doesn't have any knowledge of me. It's basically just looking at the angle and then using an AI algorithm to try to estimate how much it is. So it will be dependent on the light and angle and things like that. But the nice thing is I can use it. And you also notice that little smiley face has neutral right now. If I smile, I'm happy. And so you can even do sentiment analysis as part of the picture. And again, this simple API you can call in the cloud. What's nice is you can also do face detection setup. So, for example, I could search on Scott Guthrie. Nope. And this is doing a Bing search looking for pictures of me on the internet, old pictures with more hair. It's great. That's a really good one. Some of these people aren't me. That is like hipster me. That's not me either. And this guy looks like me in prison. But anyway. And hopefully you're not here. anyway. Anyway, so I'm just going to basically upload some of these pictures I got off the internet. And now you'll notice if I actually go back to this demo and rerun it, we've now trained the model with some pictures of me. And so you'll notice not only is it detecting my face, it's approximating my age, but it now thinks it's Scott Guthrie with about 63% confidence. And these weren't like pictures I took this morning or that I took just a few minutes ago. These are literally pictures that are at least 3 or 4 years old. But it's been able to kind of look at it and say, well, you know, his nose, his eyes, you know, his shape of his face looks a certain way, and is able to kind of roughly approximate that. And so that's a simple way. If you think about, you know, you're in Facebook or Instagram, you upload a picture, it identifies your friends, it offers you to tag people it doesn't know, and gives you a couple suggestions. That's all using an API algorithm like this. And you can now build apps that do the same, along with a lot more. And so the beauty, again, is you don't have to be a data scientist. You can use these things, add intelligence into your apps, and start to do some pretty powerful stuff. Now, the other thing you can do, of course, then, is build your own algorithms. And so, you know, the thing that's super powerful about building your own algorithms is you can now take your own data and basically use it to turn into intelligence to be able to take the past and predict the future. And, you know, at a high level, the beauty is you can do this for tons and tons of different scenarios. In fact, before I talk about what we do, let me talk about just some of the customers that are using this today inside Azure. You know, they include companies doing manufacturing. And so I'll walk you through a demo here in just a few minutes of one of them that's taking pictures of the of output on the manufacturing line and then basically doing deep learning on top of the their picture archive to be able to detect, is this thing been printed correctly and manufactured correctly, or is it something we should remove and actually do inspection on because maybe there's a fault? We've got customers like ThyssenKrupp or Otis Elevators that make a lot of the elevators that you go up and down in New York in these tall buildings. And they're now putting IoT sensors in the elevator where they basically look at vibration and heat data off of the elevator motor and are able to predict with a great deal of accuracy, will the motor break down in the next week? The way they did that is they just took the telemetry from motors that had broken down and had not broken down, knew the outcome, and then basically plugged in and looked at the data and are basically able to look for anomalies and whether or not it's signaling similar to other breakdowns they've seen in the past. And you know, now they can send a service technician to fix it before it breaks down, which makes their customers happier. It means their SLAs are higher, and they can now actually build completely new types of services and sell them and make more money. Other companies using Azure with machine learning today include like Rolls-Royce and GE, who make aircraft engines, Boeing and Airbus, who make airplanes. And they're able to take telemetry off the engine and, again, do preventative maintenance as well as even do richer fuel management capabilities that you know aren't related to the engine but are obviously closely correlated and are able to kind of help provide airlines ways to save money, and in turn, they can make money as well. And then lastly, if you buy a new BMW, a new Ford, a new Toyota, a new Renault, a new Nissan, and soon a new Mercedes, telemetry from your vehicle is actually getting uploaded inside Azure, where machine learning is, again, applying on it, and they're able to do telematics and advanced predictions for service quality and to be able to help run your car better. So those are just examples of people that are using it today. And you can do it too. And the Azure Machine Learning Service, again, makes it pretty easy to take any data and turn it into intelligence. And it does a couple different things to help with this. One is there's both now a service that runs inside the cloud as well as what's called the Azure Machine Learning Workbench, which is a client-side tool that runs on either a PC or a Mac and basically can connect to the service and help you build AI algorithms faster. And specifically, it has a whole bunch of work to do what's called data preparation. So you can effectively take data that you have, and often the data that you have might be in log files, might be years old, it might be missing data in certain places, and it helps you effectively do data wrangling to get the data clean so that you can actually train an algorithm off of it. And a lot of data scientists will tell you that's about 80% of their job, is just trying to get the data in the right shape so that they can actually start building models against it. It also includes support for using pretty much any AI framework out there, whether it's Spark or TensorFlow or Cognitive Toolkit or Caffe2 or Keras. You can take advantage of all those. And it also has broad Jupyter Notebook integration, which is an open source framework that makes it really easy to iteratively and fast create models in a group environment. And then what's nice about our machine learning service is the output of the machine learning service is a Docker container. And so we talked about containers before lunch. And the beauty is you can take one of these AI models, run it in a container, and then deploy it anywhere inside Azure, in a container service, or an Azure Container Instance, or in their Azure Batch service, and run it across hundreds of thousands of nodes, and be able to kind of operationalize it. And because it's Docker, you can even take it on premises and run it on your existing systems. You can even run it on other cloud providers if you wanted to. So it gives you a lot of flexibility to basically use this AI capability everywhere. And so what we're going to do is have Seth come on stage and walk you through a demo of one of our customers, a company called Jabil, that does manufacturing. And as I mentioned earlier, what they wanted to do was basically figure out ways that they could optimize their manufacturing to be able to detect failures in their manufacturing process better. They've got sort of tens of thousands of pictures of circuit boards and other circuits that they've manufactured. And what they want to do is, how can we take these pictures where we have a picture of what we've done in the past, we know whether there was a failure or not, could we use the pictures to basically look at new things that we produce and basically estimate from a new picture whether or not it's going to break down or whether it has a fault. And if we can do that, we can basically be much more accurate about detecting problems in our assembly and take corrective action much faster. So it's a simple problem, but it has dramatic business impacts if they can get it right. And Seth's going to walk you through how they did it.
Awesome. So they're going to throw up a picture here of one of those circuit boards that Jabil would create. Now, as a regular programmer, we are tasked with making a program that when we see this picture and they click on it, it either says, this is a good one, or it says, this is a bad one. Now, I saw there was one data scientist here. So for everyone else as a programmer, you are literally thinking, I'm going to make a function that takes a picture, and then I have to write a series of steps in order to get the thing to say yay or nay, right? Some of you are looking at this right now, even in your heads, thinking, okay, well, if I just sample the middle of the picture and I test for orange, that's probably bad, right? Some of you are literally thinking this as a programmer, because as programmers, we get a problem and we try to come up with a series of steps to answer the problem. Now, machine learning is a little bit different, and it turns sort of everything on its head, which makes it a little bit more confusing sometimes, but I'm going to walk you through it. Instead of trying to think of a series of steps to solve a problem, think instead of giving the computer examples of the right thing to do, and then it figures it out. And the output of that is also going to be something like a function, but we call it a model. And that model, when you give it a new example, should tell you whether it's a good chip or a bad chip, and it usually gives you a probability score as well. So how do we do that? Well, you know, the first step is you have to give the computer a lot of examples. And then you have to build a model, and then you have to put that model somewhere where your other programs can consume it. I'm going to show you how Azure Machine Learning Workbench helps you do exactly just that. Azure Machine Learning Workbench is a combination of Azure services and tools for machine learning with a dev GUI and command line support that helps you with data preparation, building models, and deploying models. So let me show you what that looks like. The first thing we need to start with always is we need to start with the data, because you have to give it examples. These are the examples that Jabil gave us. They gave us pictures, and in the picture, they wrote whether it was a good one or a bad one. And so you know you have to tell the computer, here's the picture and here's the good one or the bad one. So many of you in your heads, again, are thinking about some crazy regular expression to pull pass or fail out. That's not good. We don't want to do that. And with Azure Machine Learning Workbench, it's going to help you fix that. So you can see here is Azure Machine Learning Workbench. On the left-hand side, you can see I have all of the files and folders or everything that you would need. We're using Python in this case, and I'm going to zoom in so you can see as well. So the idea is we need to take out of this pass or fail, we need to get whether it's a pass or a fail in order for the computer to know if it's a good example or a bad example. So traditionally, like I said, you would use a regular expression. What we're going to do is we're going to derive column by example. So I'm going to zoom in because I want everyone to see that's the button. So when I do that, I'm going to right-click, derive column by example, and you can see it's going to start to do some nothing. So I'm going to say this is pass. This one I'm going to load up here. Looks like it figured that one out. So I'll zoom in so you can see. Notice that it's getting some of them wrong, but do you see how it's like figuring it out? This is one of the cool things about Azure Machine Learning Workbench is that for the data wrangling, we also put some smarts in it so you don't have to write ugly code. We can write it for you. So I'm going to go ahead and this one's a failure. I'll hit there. Notice that it did a pretty good job. One of them that it did not do a good job was this one, but that's okay. I'll tell it pass, that this one's also a pass. And you can see that now we have this whole column that we automatically were able to build for you that has pass or fail. The other thing that's also really cool about this is, as you can see on the right-hand side, we actually stored the things that you did so that you can run this on other things as well. It's called the data preparation step. Once we prepare our data, it's time to build our models. Now, if you're a data scientist, you probably use Python or R or whatever you use. We don't care. We're agnostic to compute cycles. We just want them in our cloud. So let me go over here to the model and evaluation. You can see we're using this thing called Jupyter Notebooks. And Jupyter Notebooks lets you type in code and play stuff because data science is exactly that. Data science. You're going to try a lot of stuff until something works. We've already done all the hard work, and so I'm showing you like the hindsight 2020 nice code. But if your code doesn't look very good and you're doing a lot of experiments, that's okay too. You can do it here. So I'm going to go ahead and hit Shift Enter on this so you can start to see that it's running some stuff. You can see right here that I'm using the data preparation step that I just did. It's a dprep file that has code in there that will automatically do the pass or fail for you. Okay, I'm going to keep going, running down. Notice that we're going to build a deep learning model here. And an example here, let me put number one here because this is one that actually passes. So there's the one that passes. And I hit down, notice that one's good. So I'm going to go down over here as well, change this to number two because that's the one that does not fail. And you can see that I'm just running code like I would. When you're doing these models, some of them are going to be better than others. So here's an example run of all the models that we've built. We picked the best one, and with Azure Machine Learning Model Management, you can actually package these up into Docker files, or to Docker containers, as Scott said, and put them pretty much anywhere. And now, this thing, remember you were going to write your own function? This model, which is a function, now you can give it any picture, and it will return to you whether it's a pass or fail with either high confidence or low confidence. So when it comes to AI and machine learning, you can do this too. We have Azure Machine Learning Workbench to help you. We have services in the background like Azure Machine Learning that can also help you. And if you just want to see what's in a picture, you can use some of the stuff, services that Scott was talking about. Thank you so much for your time.
Awesome. Thanks, Seth. You know, and the cool thing here is you can literally take any data and, you know, start to actually train models. And, you know, for things like, you know, anomaly detection and others, we have pre-built in samples and code that you can use. And so you don't even have to, in many cases, you know, become a huge data science expert to be able to start taking data and using this type of approach and very quickly getting some real value out of it. And, you know, as you add more data and as you train more models, you know, your apps can become smarter and smarter. And they really can be hugely transformative in what you do. So we talked about a lot of stuff today. And usually this is the part of the presentation where people say, okay, I'm super excited about the cloud now. I want to use Azure. But I have this problem, which is there's particular scenarios where I can't use it yet for potentially a variety of different reasons. And that's where Azure Stack comes into play. And Azure Stack gives you the ability to take advantage of Azure pretty much anywhere, even for the scenarios where either you don't think you can use public cloud or you're not quite ready to use public cloud yet. And Azure Stack gives you the same programming model, the same management APIs, the same management portal, the same development tools that public cloud Azure gives you, and gives you the same core services like app service, like serverless functions, like container service, and like infrastructure that you'd use inside public cloud Azure. And basically, you can use it for a variety of things. And I would say broadly, we see kind of three trends in particular that most organizations find Azure Stack super useful. And again, you don't have to use it for everything, but it's, you know, if you've got a workload, for example, that runs at the edge and needs to be disconnected at times, Azure Stack's perfect in a way that public cloud might not. Let me give you an example of one of these customers that's looking to do something like this. Carnival Cruise Lines uses Azure today for fleet management, and they have a data lake where they take telemetry off their ships once they port, come into port, and they can basically track how the health of the ship is doing and where it is and the operations around it. So they like public cloud, they like Azure. The problem is they can't use Azure everywhere because when the ship is out at sea, it doesn't always have an internet connection. And so if you have an onboard ship safety system or something that's actually running the ship, it's probably not the best idea to require an internet connection because if you're caught in a storm out in the ocean, you're gonna be in real trouble if you can't connect to the internet. And so now they can actually put an Azure Stack on the ship and actually build their apps the same way they would in a public cloud, but run it now completely disconnected with no need to have an internet connection working in order for those applications to run. You know, another case, an example, would be to be able to meet every regulatory requirement. I talked at the beginning of the talk about how Azure now has more compliance certifications than any other public cloud vendor. And so whether you want DoD DISA Level 5, whether you want SOC 2, PCI, HIPAA, FDA, you know, we have audits and certifications that allow you to build apps that can meet those things. But there's still sometimes additional certifications or unique requirements that you can't meet. You know, another example of a customer that's using Azure Stack for this would be EY, or Ernst & Young. They're one of the largest professional services firms in the world. They do sensitive things like tax audits that have some of the most sensitive data that a company owns that they need to store and analyze. But they're able to use Azure and public cloud for most of their clients now. And so if you're a Fortune 500 company and you're going through an audit through your auditor, there's a decent chance you might be using Azure already for that. But there's some places like Russia that have additional unique requirements, and that is that the data can't leave Russian soil. And so they can't take some of that data and put it in public cloud because there's no public cloud region currently yet available in Russia. The good news is they can now use Azure Stack. And so they can stand up their own instance with the same application running on it in Russia and meet all those local requirements. And many, many countries have unique requirements like that. I was just in an oil and gas conference a couple weeks ago, and you know, geographic seismic data for oil and gas is considered a state secret for many, many countries. And so they also can't export that outside their sovereign boundaries. With Azure Stack, you can do all those types of scenarios and meet literally any regulatory boundary in any country. And then last but not least, you might have an existing system like a mainframe or an Exadata system that requires incredibly low latency for it to run. And you need to have an app that sits next to it because of those latency needs. Again, with Azure Stack, you can actually start to modernize your apps using the same kind of DevOps, same monitoring models and stuff that we showed here today. And you can run it next to that system. And then at some point, if you do want to migrate that system, you can migrate both of them to the public cloud and not have to rewrite your apps. So again, Azure Stack is something to look at if you need to be able to run cloud literally everywhere. And it's a unique aspect that Azure has that no other cloud provider delivers. We're now shipping Azure Stack systems together with hardware partners. So we partner with HP, with Dell, with Cisco, and Lenovo. And so you can literally order both hardware and software, have it show up, and basically have a private cloud consistent with Azure anywhere you want in a matter of about a day or two once it's operational. And again, use the same management tools and development tools as part of it. And you've seen kind of Azure Stack is just part of our overall hybrid cloud story. I think throughout these demos, I've showed you, you know, how do you monitor systems for patch compliance and inventory, not just in our cloud, but others. We talked about with the CI/CD workflow. You can use VSTS for on-prem apps, for Azure apps, even for AWS apps. With data, we talked about SQL. You can have your SQL databases run on-prem. You can have your SQL databases run in the cloud. And then obviously with Azure Stack, you have a complete cloud story that runs everywhere. And so, you know, all this hybrid capability is really around giving you flexibility and allowing you to easily integrate with what you already have. And with it, you can be more successful. So hopefully throughout the last two or three hours, you've seen lots and lots of demos that hit on these four points: productive, hybrid, intelligent, trusted. And, you know, hopefully you've seen a lot of stuff here that you might want to check out as a developer and start using. In terms of actually using Azure, one of the things, if you haven't already taken advantage of it, that you can also do, I'm going to make sure people know about, is if you go to the Azure.com website, assuming the network's back, there we go, you can go ahead and click the Start Free button to try out our trial. We have $200 of credits we give you on day one of starting a trial, and so that basically gives you a month that you can spend these credits on anything that you saw today. So you can spin up databases, GPU clusters, AI services, serverless, containers, and more. And the other thing that we've just done, I just want to make sure people know about, is after the first $200 credits are used, we then give you an extra year of a whole bunch of services that you can use for 12 months. And this includes you can run a Linux or Windows VM for a year, not paying us anything. You can create lots of disks. You can create a 250-gigabyte database. You can create a Cosmos DB instance with 5 gigabytes of storage and more, and basically not pay anything. and take advantage of these for free for 12 months. And so this gives you a nice way that you can now continue your trial and start to use a core set of services at no cost to become even more familiar. So definitely something to check out, and gives you kind of more and more options, hopefully to be successful and learn what you can do with Azure. So with that, we've kind of broad survey course of a whole bunch of stuff that's in Azure. What I'm going to do now in the remaining 45 minutes is basically walk through a bunch of tips and tricks that I think both for people that are new to Azure, but also especially for people that even have used it for a while, will hopefully give you some good takeaways that you might want to jot down as notes and help you be even more successful as you start using any of these different types of services inside Azure and start building and playing around with it. So the first tip and trick I was going to show you is something that surprisingly few people actually still do. We have, you know, maybe 20% of Azure customers know about this. But it's something I always like to demo, because usually when I do, people say, now I get how I can use this more, which is the ability when you use Azure to create what's called dashboards. And so you see here I have a dashboard that I'm using that has a whole bunch of my resources pinned to it. And then the tip is basically make sure you use multiple dashboards in Azure and you'll be even more productive. So how many people here have multiple dashboards? Okay, only a few hands. So for people that are going, what does that mean? Basically, this thing called new dashboard that's right on the tile here is something you can do. And so if I want to say I want to have a New York City dashboard, I can create one. And what's cool about this is I can then go ahead and on any resource I want to use. So for example, let's click on this one right here. I can pin anything to the dashboard. And so if you look up here, any place there's a pin button, just click it and it will pin it to the dashboard. I can also pin any metric. So this is a custom set of metrics I'll just pin on the dashboard. And then you'll notice when I go back now, I have sort of these views here of these different resources. I can customize them further if I want to. So I can say customize. Let's go ahead and make that 2x1. I could resize this and move it around. Do whatever I want. I don't know why that one's not working, so get rid of that. But basically, I can lay anything out however I want, give it whatever name I want. And then the cool thing is I can easily flip between dashboards with basically just the flip of a switch and see exactly what I'm customizing. And what this is nice is, you know, two things I often see people do with this that's very powerful is have a dashboard per project that they're working on. And that way, project one and project two and project three can have the resources you most often use and then the most frequently used monitoring tiles associated with it. And then as you work between project one and project two, you can switch. We have other teams that use this for DevOps, and so they'll actually have kind of their development workflow dashboard for what they're doing for dev, and then have a detailed monitoring dashboard with lots and lots of different metrics. And that way, if someone, they see an alert, which we'll talk about in just a few minutes, fires up, they can immediately switch into their monitoring dashboard and see here are the top 20 key metrics that I want to look at to try to pinpoint what's going wrong. And again, can help you be even more successful and have the context you need for the task at hand. So again, simple trick, but one that only a few people have taken advantage of. The other little trick I'll mention is search. And so for example, if I type in New York here, you can actually see, click if it's fast and you click. You can basically see all of the resources we've created here while we've been during the event. You can basically search on types, you can search on names. There's a nice fuzzy text search, and this is also a super fast way that if you want to pull up, for example, let's say a network security group, search on it, and then basically it can jump immediately to that particular resource and load it immediately. So another little simple tip and trick to be more productive in your dashboard, something everyone can use. How many people have used the Azure Advisor? Okay, a couple people, but again, a lot of people are like, I don't know about the Azure Advisor. And this is probably the tip that so far this week has surprised people the most that have been using Azure. It's a really cool service that we launched almost a year ago, but still doesn't have enough awareness. And basically where the Azure Advisor service works is think of it like a free consulting service that you can call upon at any point in time that will look at exactly what you're doing in Azure and make recommendations on how you can do it better. Sounds good, right? Basically, to use it, all you need to do is go to the left nav, and usually towards the bottom, there's this thing called Advisor, and you click it. And what this now runs is a service that's going to basically analyze your actual subscription. So this isn't like generic suggestions. This is actually looking at the VMs you're deployed, the apps you've deployed, the databases you deployed, and it's going to give you recommendations on a couple different metrics. So for example, it'll tell you how to be more reliable, and it will recommend, hey, you've got a single point of failure here. You haven't configured this for high availability, and tell you how to fix that. It'll look at all your services and tell you where you're doing things that are not secure or don't represent secure best practices and how to fix it. It'll tell you places where, from a performance perspective, you're hitting peak loads. And so it's actually looking at my raw telemetry right now, and I have hundreds of resources in this subscription, so it's going to take a little while on this one. And it'll tell you, hey, you're bumping up to potential caps so that if you have a peak load period, you're probably going to have problems. And then also, it'll look at all your resources and tell you how to save money and pay us less. When did you last hear someone offer that? So click on this one, for example. And basically, in looking at my subscription, it said, hey, you should be paying us, paying Microsoft, ooh, it changed. There we go. You should be paying us $3,692 less a month than you are today. That's a pretty good deal. So what is it doing? Well, basically what it did was it looked at all my different resources here. And you can see, for example, I have 42 VMs, where basically according to what Azure's looking at, it's saying you're not really using these VMs that well, because the average CPU, and it's calculating it right now, is less than 5% on average across these systems. Highly recommend you either consolidate them, so move a couple of the VMs together, or resize them to be something smaller, because you don't need this much capacity. And if you do this, you'll save literally $3,600. And this is not sort of hypothetical. This is really looking at your activity over the last 30 days and able to basically show your usage patterns and then basically show you how to either shut down the VM or resize it to be something smaller and save you money. What's nice about any of the recommendations we show is not only do we show you why we're showing it, but also there's this little button here called snooze that you can optionally take advantage of if you think this is a great tip, but I don't want to do it right now because I got to go home, or Black Friday's coming up. I don't really want to be changing things at this point. I want to make sure I do it after Black Friday. Just click the snooze button, and then tell us when you want us to remind you. And so you'd say, 3 months from now, after the holiday, remind me. Click snooze, and this now will disappear from the recommendation list, and 3 months later, it'll pop back up. And so again, it's a pretty good recommendation I'd have, which is every week, run this thing, and then go through the list, and anything you're not ready, just hit snooze. But try to get a clean list of everything in your Azure Advisor, and you'll have better reliability, better security, you will pay less, and better performance. So those are all good things. It's hard not to want to do that, and it's free. So you literally don't have to pay anything. Yep. Good question. I think so, but I'm not 100% sure. I'm not sure actually what the right behavior is, and I think there is a way to unsnooze stuff too. But shoot me an email, I can find out for sure. I'm not sure if it does it user-wise or subscription-wise. The other thing you can do is you can download any of these things as both a CSV file or as a PDF. And so this is literally version of this report in PDF form. And so if you're like a consultant and you want to come in and help a customer optimize their system and impress them, just generate the PDF and email it to them. And or the CSV file, in which case you can replace our name with yours. It's another nice format you can use from a printed paper perspective that's often useful. And there is an API for everything. So you can also programmatically query it to see what recommendations you have or don't have. Good question. Can you extend it to look at the on-premise resources as well? Certain things, yes. So security, and I'll go deeper in security in just a little bit, you can. I don't believe for performance we do, partly because we don't know what we'd recommend to you on-prem, because we don't know actually what you're running on. But security, you can extend it. And then I believe it'll work with Azure Stack as well. So it will probably work in your Azure Stack instance if you're using that on-prem. But security definitely will work on-prem. So anyway, definitely recommend checking out Azure Advisor. Again, it's free, and you know, it can really help quite a bit. Let's talk about security then. This is the other one that you know, I talked about a lot in the database section in the context of data. But you know, this is another free service inside Azure that we've built in that is really good, that also really helps you from a operations perspective, and is I think really important to go ahead and use. And you know, what's nice about the Security Center is, again, the best practices it provides, and they do flow in through Azure Advisor as well, but you can get more details in the Security Center. The best practice recommendations are all free. So this prevention section here at the top with all those things, that's free. That's, you can just use that for free. We give that to everyone. And basically what this is doing is, again, analyzing how you're using Azure, your subscription, and giving you a personalized set of recommendations on what you should do to be more secure based on what you're actually doing. So this isn't like a hypothetical 120 best practice. This is like best practices based on what you've deployed. So for example, if I look on compute, it's looking at my subscription and saying, you've got 102 VMs that have some problems. And so for example, some of these VMs don't have anti-malware protection turned on. And so you don't have any endpoint protection. Some of these things have OS vulnerabilities that you haven't patched, whether they're Windows or Linux will actually tell you which ones. Some of them don't have system updates. So in other words, service packs come out a year or two ago, you don't have it applied. Some of them don't have disk encryption turned on. Encryption at rest is a feature that we now have on by default for all of our storage drives. Some drives that were created, say, 2 years ago don't have it on by default yet, and you gotta go, you can turn it on, but the feature didn't exist then with custom keys. And this is basically saying you have 76, you still need to turn it on, and so forth. And so these are all, again, not hypothetical, but actually based on your particular subscription. Similarly, on the network, we can tell you when you have ports open. So it's often common to have management ports that you've exposed to the internet. If someone guesses your password, you're gonna be in trouble. And so this will tell you which ports you have open. This will even tell you also if you've got too many systems that are just talking to each other, and we'll recommend putting in a network security group, which basically will block traffic between some of your systems so that if one part of your system gets hacked, a person can't move laterally throughout the network and attack you in other places as well. Similarly, on the database side, you know, all of those recommendations and the security threat analytics will come through here as well. But it will also tell you if you're not, if you haven't turned on TDE encryption on your database, or you aren't taking advantage of other certain features, it'll be shown up and flow through there. Again, this is all free, so there's really no reason not to run it on a pretty regular basis. You can also, this is sort of a paid feature of the Security Center, because we have to capture a lot of logs and analyze them, is this security alert capability. And what this will do is it'll actually analyze your log files and tell you when we think you're being attacked by someone else. And you might say, gosh, I don't want to be attacked. Well, the reality is if you have an IP address in the world today, you're probably being attacked. Most IP addresses on the internet get attacked about 100 times a day. If you don't know you're being attacked, it's because you don't have monitoring for that, not because you're not being attacked. And so the nice thing is this will actually tell you when you're being attacked and by whom. And we can also give you a sense of whether or not they've been successful or not, and what steps that you can take to better protect yourself against it. So for example, one of these attacks here, you can see, is against a VM here. And you can see that someone is trying to hack into it by basically accessing a management port. So in other words, let's say you have a remote desktop port open, and you can see basically this IP address tried 138 times to log into it. None of them were successful. And so someone probably bought, say, a password dictionary off the internet that has, say, 100,000 passwords in it, and they're just cycling through the passwords, hoping that you happen to have password 1234, protecting your being an admin on the machine and getting in. And unfortunately, you know, with 100,000 passwords, there's a high probability of hit rate in most systems, because unfortunately, most passwords aren't terribly unique, and you know, you can be attacked. And so this is telling you you are being attacked, And if you read more, it'll say, here's what you should do to avoid being attacked, which is you shouldn't have this port open at all, because you know, even with the most secure password, people can still try, and at some point, they might be able to guess it. And so other things you could do is you could turn off the port completely, and there's instructions in that thing on how to do it. Or the other cool feature that we now have that's pretty unique is now in public preview is something we call just-in-time VM access, which is something else we recommend turning on and is integrated as part of this experience. Is anyone here using a just-in-time access control model with their systems on-prem today? A couple of people occasionally do. It's often hard to implement, especially if you want to do it at the network level, because most on-premises networks aren't designed to kind of like open and close ports dynamically without someone working across many management tools to do it. And so as a result, you often have lots of ports open on your network all the time, and you rely on passwords to those servers to prevent access. Well, you can do a just-in-time access, you can go one step further and say, well, why don't we not have the ports ever open, except when someone actually needs it, and then only for a short period of time. And it's a nice defense-in-depth mechanism you can use to lock down further. And so the way this works is I can choose on any system to enable what's called just-in-time access, or JIT. And the way this works is I can basically get a listing of all the common management ports that this VM might be using. And so, for example, port 22 for SSH, some of the other ports for remote desktop and so forth. And then what I can do is either close them permanently or set up a just-in-time access rule. And what this is going to basically say is someone is allowed to go to port 22, but to do that, they first got to say, I need access, and it'll be logged as to who requested it. You can basically provide an IP address range, and so effectively say, hey, we're only going to allow your machine to access it during that window when it's open, and lock down at the network level based on IP address. And then I can do a max time window so that if, say, Bob goes and says, I need to access this machine to run a script, it'll open it up, but it'll make sure if Bob forgets to close it or log off, within 3 hours, it'll close automatically, or whatever period you specify in that range. And so that way, even if an administrator forgets to lock it back down, it'll auto-lock down on them after that period of time. And once you set that up, then you have this rule. No one can attack that port because the port is not accessible on the network. And then if someone does need to log in and run a script or do something to it, they can just go request JIT for an hour, go in, do it, and either manually close it or know that it'll automatically close after them, even if they've forgotten to, and keep you even further secure. That's a nice built-in feature that works across all VMs in Azure, again, whether it's Windows or Linux, and no other cloud provider has it. And then the last feature that's in preview right now, and you can register for the preview, is what we call application whitelisting. That's another kind of advanced feature that a lot of companies that are very security conscious are starting to implement. And what that does is it basically allows you to say on a particular server or VM, only these binaries are allowed to run. And you can basically provide a whitelist of those binaries. And that means that basically if your system is compromised with malware and it tries to run a new binary that contains a virus, it will not be able to allow to run and allows you to be forcibly shut down. And that gives you a way that you can basically, as part of your production system, lock down exactly what code is allowed to execute. And then again, Azure will basically ensure that nothing but those binaries execute. And it's another good defense in depth mechanism that you can take advantage of. And it's built in here to the Security Center. Everything I'm showing here is available through APIs. We also expose connectors. So if you have, for example, existing security tools like Splunk or Sumo Logic or ArcSight that your security operations team might use, they can just point their tools at Azure and use our APIs, and the data will show up in the tools that they already use. And so alerts and things like that will just flow through the existing security tools they're familiar with. And so it makes it really easy also for enterprises that have sophisticated security teams to be able to take advantage of and use Azure immediately. Role-based access control. This is another one where I mentioned earlier about, you know, unfortunately, at least once a week, we get a panic call from someone who says, I accidentally deleted my production database. And it wasn't because they were being dumb. It was typically because they got distracted. They're talking to someone. They go to delete something. They don't realize they're deleting the production instead of the dev test system. And Best way to prevent that is to make sure that very few people are allowed to delete the database, and that you use something like what's called role-based access control to lock it down. In addition to allowing you to avoid honest mistakes, it also means that if a username and password are ever compromised, no one can log in as that person and do malicious stuff either. And so using role-based access control is a great way to effectively make yourself more secure and then also prevent accidents that might happen. And basically within Azure, we have a notion of roles and role assignments. And so you can create a role like admin or developer or operator or read-only. And then you can map any users you want into those roles, and you can control what each of those roles can actually do. And the way the roles work, and the way permissions work in Azure, like most systems, is they're hierarchical. So you can basically assign permissions at the subscription level, at a resource group level, which can manage multiple resources, or at an individual resource like a VM or an app service or a storage account. And if you set it at the subscription, they'll inherit down. You can override them below, but by default, they'll inherit down. This is important when you see the demo. So let's go ahead and use role-based access control. So how many people here have used role-based access control in Azure? Cool, good, a couple of hands. For people that haven't used it, we've made it a lot easier to use than it used to be. And one of the ways we did that is pretty much on every resource in Azure, there's now the third thing from the top left, something called access control. And if you click that, it lets you control access. And specifically, you can click on it on any resource or resource group or subscription. And what this is now doing is showing me who has admin access and what privileges to manage this particular VM or resource. And so, for example, I can see what are called readers. These are people that only have read-only access to this particular resource, meaning they can't delete it, they can't change settings, and they also can't see secrets. So they can't like see the password, they can't see a certificate value. There are owners that have full permissions, meaning they can delete things, they can change anything on the resource. And then there's contributors, which basically have a subset of owner privileges, meaning they can still change things, but they can't delete it, among other things. And you know, basically what I'd recommend is before you ever go live in production, click on your resources, click access control, and look at the list and ask yourself, does everyone you have listed there need to have owner permissions? It would be great if the number of owners you had was super, super small, because that basically means the number of people who could delete this resource or who could change the security setting is extremely small. And if you have a large list, you're gonna basically probably find at some point either someone makes a mistake and configures something you didn't intend, or someone accidentally might delete something not realizing that what they're deleting is a critical resource. Usually when people click on this, they go, wow, why do I have so many people? Who is Santosh? Who is Josh? And the other kind of useful column here, which is the far right column, will tell you where they're getting this from. And so the reason why Santosh is allowed to delete this VM is because at some point in time, he was added at the subscription level in Azure and is an owner of the subscription, and so it flows down and all the resources automatically inherit it. And so whenever you see a list of people and you're like, I can't understand why we gave them permission, it's probably because you've given permission at some point in the past to the top level subscription, and then it just automatically applies everywhere. Best to take the person away from the top level subscription and then just add back the permissions to the resources they actually need to manage. And again, that'll make you a lot more secure and locked down. If you wanna add someone specifically to a resource, just click the add button on any particular access control on a resource, select the role. You can define your own roles as well. I'm just using the built-in one. And then I could basically say, let's search, let's search on Satya Nadella, our CEO. We're gonna give him read access to this particular VM, because I don't trust him to be an owner. don't tell him that. And I can click save. And this is now giving him read access into the reader role of this resource. See his name just popped up under the reader list there. So he now has read access. And so if he goes into the Azure portal, which he hopefully won't in the next 2 minutes, he will say, oh, I can manage this VM, or I can see this VM, you can't manage it. And so he just has access to that resource. If we want to take it away, I can just go ahead, hit there, and hit remove. And he's now gone. And so, you know, this is an easy way, again, reduce down how many people are owners and then just add them as readers if you need to. Readers are great roles for DevOps or for a case where you have a dev team that doesn't actually have ops permission, actually more specifically, because they can basically now monitor the resources and see what the health of them are, but not modify them. And so, you know, this reader role ends up being super useful for that. The other thing you can do, and you can do this both globally in the monitor tab in Azure or just on any resource, is click activity log. And this will now show you all of the changes that have happened on this resource. And so role assignments right now is filtered out, but let me show you those. And so you can see here, this was the delete and the assignment operation that we just did on Satya. And you know, I can basically filter who did it, when did they do it. And so if, at a later point, I'm trying to figure out why is Amy now suddenly an owner? I can actually track it down because everything is logged and saved. And so I can see what they did. So definitely recommend role-based access control and then using the activity log to constantly see who's changing what as a good best practice. The other thing that people usually ask me after they see role-based access control, they see the security center, and they say, wow, it's great that you can tell me when I'm doing something wrong. It's great that I can lock down who can do the thing wrong. Be even better if you could actually not let me set a policy so I can't do something wrong. And that's where this next thing comes into play. And this is a new service. It's sort of in limited preview right now. Everyone will be able to use it in about 2 weeks. And if you go to the website, you can use it now. But it's called Azure Policy Center. And what this is going to let you do is actually define policies so that you can prevent certain behaviors from ever happening if you want to. So for example, I showed you how with Azure Security Center, it says you should always, you know, these 72 VMs don't have encrypted disks. If you want, you can set a policy that says you can't create an Azure in, or you can't create a VM in your subscription that ever has anything but an encrypted disk. And that way, when you try to deploy the VM, it'll fail the deployment if it violates the policy. Similarly, you could say, I'm going to create a policy that says this management port is never allowed to be open on the internet, and it will fail the deployment if I have that policy turned on and someone tried to open up the port. And so this basically will give you a very powerful way that you can declaratively set your permissions for a wide range of things and then just enforce them across the organization. I think will be really, really popular and pretty differentiated. The other thing you can do is you can both deny permissions and you can also audit. And so if you've got large deployment already with a bunch of stuff, you probably don't want to say disable all VMs that don't have encrypted disks because you might end up bringing a bunch of stuff down and impacting operations. So what you can also do is move into audit mode, which basically says it'll create an audit log of here are all the policy violations, and then you can basically work to get them fixed, and then you can turn on enforcement mode later. And that is a nice way you can gradually phase in policies and learn first what would break if you kept turned it on, and then turn it on. And so that's something I definitely recommend checking out and taking advantage of. Azure Monitor is something we showed at the very beginning of the talk. And is a really powerful way that you can monitor resources across Azure. So if you remember, we did log analytics on resources using this. We did metrics. The alerting capability that's built in lets you set up alerts on metrics and on log activities. And so you can basically go ahead and programmatically set up alerts. So you can say, for example, if a VM restarts or someone turns on a resource, fire an alert. You can do hook into our service health dashboard so we can tell you if we think a VM is having any problems because of an Azure platform issue or any resource is having a problem, we can notify you programmatically. And there's a whole bunch of other, there's like 150 different things you can trigger on, and we're adding more and more over time. Definitely recommend before you go live, turn on some alerts, and that way you'll know that you have issues before your customers tell you you have issues. And you can wire these alerts up so that we send you email. We can call a webhook, so you can run like an Azure function in response to it. We can send you an SMS challenge. If you use the webhook option, you can also subscribe to a service like PagerDuty. And so we'll call PagerDuty, and then PagerDuty can page you, and that way you can actually have who's on call at a particular point in time and different windows of who would get paged if there was an issue. And then we also have an ITSM hook, and this allows you to push tickets into like ServiceNow or BMC or any ITSM system that you might be using on-prem. And that's all now built in and something you can take advantage of. And we now guarantee, or we now basically with our alerting system, within a minute of something happening, we will fire the right alert to you. And so the frequency of when we'd reach out has kind of shrunk dramatically from where we were, let's say, a year or two ago. I think most cloud providers are still in the 4 or 5 minute range. And as of last month, we've gotten all of our alerts down to be under 60 seconds, which we think is pretty good. Other things you can do in the monitor window, something to check out, especially if you're doing hybrid networking with an existing on-premises environment, is something called Network Watcher, which is also now exposed to that Azure Monitor window. This has a whole bunch of great networking diagnostic tools that can help you pinpoint when you're having network problems. And in general, I'd say, you know, networks are one of the more finicky things to get right in any enterprise. And especially when you're connecting to applications in the cloud, you can sometimes run into issues where someone changes, for example, the network rule on-prem, and something breaks, and trying to figure out where did it break and why can be difficult. One of the features, for example, you can now do in Network Watcher is actually bring up a topology map of your actual network. And so this is actually showing, not based on what you've configured or what you think it is, but this is actually looking at the network flow packets that's actually flowing through your network. And generally what we find is when you run this and it shows you the actual truth, it's often very different than the schematics you think you have in your design documents. Because again, someone might have put in a Cisco routing rule and be bouncing traffic in a different way. And this can help you understand exactly why can't machine A talk to machine B? Oh, because there's a firewall now in between, and help pinpoint that a little bit better. We also now have the ability to do packet traces and packet captures, as well as look at VPN diagnostics, as well as IP flow activity. These are also ones where we've learned the hard way helping someone debug this just with arbitrary tools is difficult, and so we're trying to make it super easy, for example, for you to say, I want to do a packet capture, make it 30 seconds between these endpoints when this happens, and so you can wire this up so an alert will turn on packet capture, save diagnostic data for 30 seconds in a storage account when latency increases or when a service becomes unavailable. And then the packet capture is in what's called a Wireshark format, and so you can pass it to a network person that knows network diagnostic tools, and Wireshark's the standard tool format they use, and then they can say, oh, it's because the VPN router apparently rebooted at that period of time. Let's go pinpoint that and try to figure out what the problem is. It's a really good tool if you're doing any type of networking and you have any expert in your company that knows networking, familiarize them with this, because when you do have a networking issue, these will be a godsend to allow you to quickly identify what's going wrong. You know, really designed to help dramatically simplify diagnosing any type of network issues you might run into. And I think right now we're the only cloud that lets you do packet trace captures, or at least we were as of a couple months ago, so it's kind of a nice differentiated feature that Azure has. Cost management. One of the things we hear often from people is, hey, I get surprised by my bill, or I don't know how much my bill is going to be. Can you help me better understand what my bill is? What am I spending money on? And then, especially as your teams might get bigger and as you use more in the cloud, how can we help you optimize your bill so you're actually spending less? And then for large teams, how can you even create budgets across your teams or across your projects so you can better track budgets and projects together with your actual usage? And this used to be something that we didn't do very well with. We just give you a bill in kind of like a raw format, and you'd have to kind of figure this out on your own. We bought a company this summer and now integrated it and given it to you for free as part of your Azure subscription called CloudIn, and that does cost management. And I'll demo it in just a second. It does a whole bunch of great tools and reports that you can slice and dice your build in any number of ways and help you optimize the spend of it in some really cool ways. And even does chargebacks and budgets, so you can even do internal chargebacks to teams or projects. We also just announced, and you'll see next month we'll officially launch and you can sign up for it, what are called VM instances, or reserve VM instances. And this basically is a way you can drop your bill another 70% by basically pre-buying certain compute capacity units. And say, I want to use this for a year, and you can assign it to any VM you want, and this drops your bill dramatically. And the combination of the cost management and this gives you nice ways that you can, again, reduce your bill and be able to use the cloud really well. So let me show you quickly how you can use this. So basically, if you go into your Azure portal, there's a cost management and billing thing on the left-hand side. If you click, it'll bring this up. And then there's a cost management button on the left. And if you click this little blue button called Go to Cost Management, we will sign you into the Cloud In service. The reason why it's a separate website is we just bought them and they've been at Microsoft like 8 weeks. And so over time, you'll see us roll this functionality more into the experience, but we wanted to get this in your hands as soon as possible and enable the single sign-on from it. The one caveat you do want to keep track of is you do need to be an owner subscription to do this, to set it up. And so you do want to make sure if for some reason you click it and it says you can't do it because you're not an owner, track the person down. And I think we even now have the email address of the person in your organization that needs to basically click the accept button because there's billing information. We just got to be careful that only the right people can turn it on. But once it's turned on, you can get access to dashboards. You can let multiple people get access to these. So you can look at your overall bill. It lets you look at all the resources you create over in a timeline view, and so you can understand, like, what in the world do we do on the 21st of September? Because it looks like we skyrocketed and stuff. Was that a mistake? Was it a project launch? What happened? You know, now this is sort of easy to create these types of reports, and they're pre-built in. You know, there's a nice little cost entity model here. So this is another visualization. So if you want to know how much are we spending on analytics, and specifically Spark, I can sort of click on Spark, and I've got to shrink this down so you can see the payment part as well. And so as I'm kind of moving around, you can see the bill up here will change. And so I can actually quickly look at resource types or project temp tags and try to understand what we're spending money on to, again, kind of slice and dice my bill to understand by workload and entities. I can look at resource utilization. So this is basically saying, I have 88 VMs that are currently using less than 25% of the CPU. And again, I can pinpoint and get that listing of VMs and optimize them further and estimate how much money it would save me if I go ahead and apply this. And I can also then look at reserved instance impact. And so I can use that last feature I talked about that's coming that lets you buy reserved instances. This allows you to model where should you use reserved instances versus pure on-demand instances, and what is the cost savings that you can get by doing it. So lots of great tools. They're free if you're an Azure user. If you use another cloud provider, they can be free if you become an Azure user and move your stuff to Azure. Or there's also a version of cloud and you pay a little bit extra and you can actually manage this across multiple clouds in a truly hybrid way. So you can actually even do comparisons between different cloud vendors with it. And so forth. And the last thing I'll just show you, and then we'll end today, is another little tip and trick that's worth just be familiarizing yourself with before you need it, which is what to do when something is going wrong and you can't figure out why. And basically, it could be our problem, it could be your problem, and often what we find is people are like, I'm not sure if it's my problem or your problem, how do I know? And the way to do that is on any resource inside Azure, go to the portal, and the last link down in the top left is called Diagnose and Solve Problems. And this is intended to help you diagnose and solve problems. And we pretty much do it for every resource. So you can even see cost management has one. But let's say, for example, I'm looking at, let's just do this VM, and I click Diagnose and Solve Problems. A couple things it does. One is at the very top, and it's tailored by the type of resource. So Diagnose and Solve Problems for a database is different than a VM, which is different than a web app. The thing that is common, though, at the top is this resource health check. This is also available as an API that you can check. But this will actually tell you immediately, does Azure think it's having a platform problem? In other words, do we think we've created some problem where either we've had a hardware failure or, for some reason, our service is having a problem that's impacting you? Or do we think we're healthy? Anytime we think we're healthy and we say we're available, it basically means from all the telemetry we're seeing for your server, we don't know of any problem that we're causing. This is really useful to know quickly because it allows you to quickly see, is it Azure's fault or is it maybe something that you did that's causing it? And it's super useful. And so you're not thinking around that, well, maybe it's an Azure problem and it'll go away in half an hour. Check this first because this is actually, whether it's green or red, is driven not sort of by some human and pushing something in a dashboard in Azure, but literally by the log telemetry coming off of the resources you're using. And so it's usually pretty accurate as to whether or not there's a platform issue occurring. We then basically will show you what have you changed in the last 24 hours. We typically see often if it is an issue that you've caused, it's often because you changed something. And so this will deep link into the activity log and actually tell you if you changed something. So you'll notice, for example, one role assignment. So if the reason is you can't access the VM anymore, click the role assignment, and it might be that someone turned off your access. And this gives you a way you can actually see who did it and when. And then basically, we have a number of what we call solutions to common problems. And we basically customize these based on the resource type. So this is a Windows VM. And so you can see to resolve these common problems, we have a list of tools that you can run and check, which basically are what the support teams will typically walk you through if you call them on the phone. But we try to basically put these in text with tools that you can run yourself so you can quickly follow these steps. And these are basically our recommended guidelines. So instead of having to do a Google search, how do I fix this? Follow the ones that we do first. And generally what we find is these fix about 80% of the issues that people typically call us about, and we update them all the time as we get new data. And then last but not least, if you can't figure it out, definitely open a support request. And you can always do this first, but we try to have all this help, self-help documentation so you can do it either in parallel or you can try quickly using some of those self-heal tools first. And if you want to open a support request, you click that button. This will create and help you fill out a support request. You can select the severity. Sev A means I'm down and I need urgent help. Sev C is more of a consulting question, or hey, you can get back to me in a couple hours, it's not super urgent. And Sev B is somewhere in the middle. Depending on your support plan, you get guaranteed levels of response depending on it. Definitely recommend buying a support plan based on what you actually need. Oftentimes one of the things we do run into is people have like truly mission critical things like country elections and they don't have a support plan. That's not a good thing to go live with. And you know, if you've got a massive retail event, buy a support plan before the retail event so you can open up 7A tickets and get help. And the basic support plan costs $19 a month. So you know, even for a basic support plan, it's not that expensive, but that'll help you make sure you can get help when you need it. And again, different levels of support plans provide different guarantees of response. So anyways, that's it, what you should do if you ever have problems. And again, check the resource availability first, check those solutions, and then you can open up a support ticket and talk to a human, obviously also if you need to. So anyway, we covered a lot of stuff today. I hope you found it really useful. A couple other places just to check out that I'll mention if you want to go further. Go to the Azure.com website, click documentation, and we've got a number of great getting started tutorials. So if you want to learn how to build a Linux VM, we've got a tutorial for the portal, for the CLI, and for PowerShell. And you know, there's nice kind of step-by-step instructions on how to do it. And so pretty much everything that I did today, we're going to send you links with quick starts on how to do yourself. The other thing to check out that's really cool is these free Pluralsight videos on Azure that you can get to on the documentation setting on the top right. And these are free multi-hour courses of Pluralsight content. Pluralsight does really great technical content. And so if you want to get started with .NET or with Node or VMs or IaaS and others, you can basically click. Scott Allen's awesome. He does great courses. And when you click on this, you can see the curriculum here. This isn't like a five-minute course video. We have those too. This will literally, you know, is a multi-hour video that goes into depth on everything you need, basically, to go end-to-end and be successful building .NET apps on Azure. He's got one for Node. We got other ones for different technologies as well. And so this is a great way if you want to go deeper really master this and get some great content. And again, it's all integrated as part of the Azure.com doc site. And with that, I'll invite Jeff back on stage. But I want to say a huge thank you to everyone for coming out today. I hope you enjoyed it. I had fun being here. Thanks.